Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Thursday evening. This is our episode of Masters of the Air. My name is Sean Hall. I'm the director of programming with the Veterans Breakfast Club. Happy to have you all joining us once again. And we will be getting to our host this evening, Glenn Flickinger, in just a minute. Glenn, how are you doing?
I'm doing excellent, Sean. Nice to see you tonight.
You as well. Nice to see you all here this evening. We're gonna run things kind of like we did last week. I have just a small announcement here at the top of the show. I'll hand it off to Glenn. We do have a poll for people who may have watched the most recent episode of Masters of the Air. And again, if you have not watched it, it's quite all right. You're going to get a lot of history tonight and a lot of stories. And it may spark that interest in watching the show. But I know I watched it. I really enjoyed it. It was a good episode. It's making me really like, what'd you say his name is? Egan?
John Egan.
John Egan. Fantastic actor. Really loving his role so far in the show. But to start things off here, I wanted to say thank you for joining us here at the Veterans Breakfast Club, which has been creating this community of listening around veterans and their stories since 2008. The programs we share connect, heal, educate, and inspire, and they are only possible with your generous support. You can donate to the Veterans Breakfast Club and become a member by visiting us at veteransbreakfastclub.org. And please do check out our website. There's a lot more to do there. You can sign up for our blog. You can sign up for our e-blasts. If you sign up to be a member, you get a free quarterly magazine. Without further ado, we'll get to a bit more of our thank yous and sponsorships and different things later on in the show. Hand it off here to Glenn. Glenn, would you like me to throw the poll up?
Yeah, throw the poll up if you would. And we'd ask you to fill in this poll here in the next 5 or 10 minutes as I'm introducing our guest tonight and getting started. And then after 10 or 15 minutes or so, we'll take a look at the poll and get the results. So please do take it. It's real simple, real quick. We've been doing it these past, three shows since the actual episodes of Masters of the Air started showing. And I think it gives us a good rolling start and getting some commentary going. So yeah, thank you everybody for being here. I'm Glenn Flickinger. I host the Greatest Generation Live programs for the VBC. Most of you know me. I see a lot of familiar faces. If you don't know me, welcome. Thank you for being on the program. We've been trying to expand our viewership. A couple of World War II roundtables have been helping with us with that. Don Patton in Minnesota, Laura Pacello in central Pennsylvania. So if you're from one of those two roundtables, welcome. Thank you for being here. This last, 5 or 6 weeks, we've been working on this every Thursday evening at 7 o'clock, Masters of the Air series. It's meant to provide some commentary, some background, a little bit deeper dive into some of the history that the TV show does not cover. I like the TV show myself. There's a lot of commentary out there on it. People have been sending me articles. I haven't had a chance to read all of them yet. Some of them not so good. Personally, I'm loving it. But then again, I'm a history nut, and being able to see the way Hanks and Spielberg and their people have put this together, I think it's just fascinating. And it's almost like you're riding on the planes with them, at least as close as you could get. Encourage you to watch it if you have the ability to get on Apple TV. So tonight we have a very special guest, one of our, what I'm calling our contributing panel, with sort of an informal way, and that's Robert Mattson. Robert, please say hello.
Hello, everyone.
We had Robert on a couple of years ago when we did a program. I believe it was January of 22, maybe 23. No, I think it was January 22. And we did a program on his book on Jimmy Stewart, Mission. And I'm going to show you that book in a little bit. Jimmy Stewart and the Fight for Europe. And it was quite a successful program for us. It's a fascinating book. And as most of you know, Jimmy Stewart was a B-17 pilot. Robert, what got you into writing that book? Because I know you've written lots of books. I think a couple on World War II, but what interested you in Jimmy Stewart?
Well, actually, he was a B-24 pilot, although he was checked out on B-17s, and he taught, he was an instructor of flyers on B-17. So, I had done this book on the crash of Carol Lombard's plane in January of 42, which was at the beginning of World War II. She was on a Bonn tour. And she died in a plane crash. And I needed another topic. And somebody said to me, you should do Stuart in the War. And I thought, I can't do that because he wouldn't talk about it. And if he wouldn't talk about it, how can I write about it? But by tracking down the records, his personnel file, the combat mission reports, you could, plus a number of flyers from his bomb group left accounts that are really thorough and riveting. And I also met three flyers who flew with him and interviewed them extensively, and they helped a great deal. So in a 360 degree way, it all came together.
Yeah. And it's a fascinating book. I really enjoyed reading it. And in another 15 minutes or so, we're going to have Robert back on and we're going to go through at least the World War II aspects of Jimmy Stewart's life. Pennsylvania boy, right up there in Indiana, Pennsylvania, where there's a museum dedicated to him, right, Robert?
That's correct.
Yeah. Which I, every year I say I'm going to make it there and I never do. So. Indiana is not exactly on any of my routes that I normally take anywhere. Okay. So again, welcome everybody. Let me start with before we get to the survey, as I've been doing a little bit of history on some of the background. So in the episode that was released last week, there's a pretty healthy part of it at the beginning of the program. Where there's a party going on in the 100th Bomb Group club, if you will, on base. And that party is recognizing the first bomber crew of the, I'm guessing, this is a little bit of guesswork, and if anybody knows this, I would please ask you to volunteer it. But I believe it's the first bomber crew of the 100th Bomber Group that made 25 missions. They use the name Charlie Robinson is just thrown out in that in that scene. And I've been researching Charlie Robinson for the past few days on the internet, even on the 100th Bomber Group Association website, and I can find no Charlie Robinson. Does anybody recognize that name as a B-17 pilot? In the 8th Air Force at all, or in the 100th Bomber Group? Colin, I was with your encyclopedic knowledge, I was hoping you might that. Yeah, we need to unmute Colin. I'm sorry, Colin.
Sorry, I'm looking for him. Can you wave, Colin? There you are.
To respond to your question, no, that's a dry hole for me. I don't know him. I don't know the name.
I'm pretty sure it's a made up name, and I think the screenwriter just wanted to recognize that point about the 25th mission, the first crew of the 100th that did the 25th mission. But I found it interesting because, and I'm going to show you this on my screen here. Let me share screen with everybody. So what I found interesting is that they talked about the 25th mission. And I want to make clear to everybody that in 1942, when the 8th Air Force and the 100th, well, the 100th Bomber Group didn't start until 1943, but in 1942 and well into the early part of 43, there was no mission number to reach. Okay, and that became a problem as we've talked about in the past weeks, the casualties mounted up when 10, 15, 20% of the bomber crews were being shot down. And it really became a problem because the morale dropped. And this man, General Malcolm Groh, who was the 8th Air Force Chief Medical Officer in the winter of 1942-43, so in sort of January, February of 43, went to the 8th Air Force commander at that time, Ira Ager, and said, "Hey, you've got a real problem. Morale is terrible. We got a record number of people in the hospital, some of them in the combat fatigue mode, if you will. And I think you need to do something about it." So this was the man that talked Ira Ager into establishing that 25 mission limit in order to give the boys, as they put it, the pilots and the crews, a number to reach for, and some hope that there was some way out of this other than death, serious injury, or being captured. So that's how the 25th, and that's when the 25th mission number came about. And this man, who I love to find these men who are lost to history, is the man who recommended it to Ager, and Ager took it. Okay. I think most people would recognize, let me try to advance this now. So this was General Malcolm Groh, the man I was talking about, who was the head of the 8th Air Force, chief medical officer, who went to Ira Ager and recommended the 25 missions for the reasons I mentioned. Okay. So this is the first plane and the first crew on this plane who in May of 1943 achieved the 25 mission mark. And it's a plane called Hell's Angels, not a plane called Memphis Belle. I think the majority of our population would think it was the Memphis Belle because that was the one that got played up in the publicity area by the 8th Air Force, went on the famous Bond tour, and it became the subject of a movie about 15, 20 years ago. This, in fact, was the first bomber to make 25 missions. And it was not with the 100th, it was with another bomber group. These are the men of the Hells Angels. Most of these men were on most of those missions. And it was captained by one Captain Earl, and that is the correct spelling, IRL, E. Baldwin. And after they achieved that status, this is the ground crew. They took this picture when to celebrate the ground crew, and the ground crew was actually given an award as well. And that's something actually in the series I've been very pleased to see that they're recognizing the ground crew. There's a couple of excellent young actors that are portraying the ground crew, and they're recognizing the importance of the ground crew. And certainly all the pilots and crewmen always recognize the importance of the ground crew. This is a picture of that crew on their Bond tour, which then happened subsequently in late 43 and early 44. And I just thought it was an interesting picture because it's got Humphrey Bogart in it and Lauren Bacall.
Yep.
Which is she's quite a lady. This picture also had there's a similar picture with the Memphis Belle that is out there, and this is when they visited a factory, I believe, and all the workers were signing the bomber. This is the actual bomber that was shown to the workers and used in the publicity tour. So just a little bit of history there. I thought particularly talking about the 25th mission and how that came about would be of some interest because that gets played up a lot. You're going to see it more and more. And it plays directly, I believe, into the story we're going to hear from Robert Mattson about Jimmy Stewart and the issues that Jimmy Stewart suffered subsequently with respect to what we would now call PTSD, which they called fatigue back then.
Well, do you want to know why what Curtis LeMay said as to why Hell's Angels didn't get the accolades Memphis Belle did?
I would love to know that, Colin. Yes.
They didn't think the name Hell's Angels was politically correct and that the public would accept it, so Memphis Belle was more palatable.
Ah, it's also the reason the Memphis Belle name that I'm sorry, who was the film producer? Wyler? Was that, do I have that name right?
Corky shaking his head, yes.
Yeah, Wyler. He picked the Memphis Belle because the first plane that he was filming and following for this was shot down in a mission. When he found that out, he got in his Jeep with a couple of his crew, and they drove up and down the line of planes looking for another plane. And he saw the name Memphis Belle, and he saw the artwork on it, which was a pinup girl. And without meeting the crew, without knowing anything about the plane, he said, "That's the plane we're going to follow." Have you heard that story, Colin?
I knew Bob Morgan quite well and his wife Linda. I have heard that story from Bob himself.
Yeah. I did not know the part about, Hell's Angels being a, negative thought, I guess, relative to publicity.
And Bob Morgan said that he would have named his plane "Shit on the Shingle" if it got him home faster.
Yeah. Good old SOS, a standard military dish, which
Yeah.
I had many times growing up as an army brat. We're going to move to Robert Mattson's book on Jimmy Stewart. And there's the cover of the book. Very handsome man there. Must have been a movie star. Jimmy Stewart, where earlier, if you weren't on, I asked Robert to explain how he got to write this book, and he gave a great explanation. Leonard Maltin, that's a name I recognize. Movie critic, wasn't he? Why Leonard Maltin with the Ford, Robert?
Well, because the book starts and ends with the production of It's a Wonderful Life, which was the picture he made after returning from the war. And Leonard has a great fondness for It's a Wonderful Life. He's written extensively about it, and I thought that was a nice sort of synergy between World War II and Hollywood.
Okay. Wow. I've forgotten that. It's been a 2 years since we last talked to you, and a couple of years since I read the book. But yeah. So I didn't want to do too much. Robert and I didn't want to do too much on Jimmy Stewart's life before the war, but what a life. This is him with his best friend, Henry Fonda, who they were, I recall, they were friends in New York City at first. Is that correct, Robert?
They go all the way back to Jim's Princeton days when he first got involved with the University Players, and then he did summer stock on Cape Cod, and that's where he met DeFonda.
Quite a friend to have. And this is Jim now out in LA. He's already an established star. And this is one of his many, many, many early girlfriends. Did I get that many part right?
Yeah, that's Margaret Sullivan. They were close. Yes, they were close.
He was quite the ladies' man, as I recall, in the 30s.
He was, and he thought of himself tall and gawky and unattractive. And so he had to prove to himself that he was attractive. And so he did it with all the A-listers that he had seen on the screen while he was a starving actor in New York, and that was Ginger Rogers, Marlena Dietrich, Norma Shearer, and the list goes on. Olivia de Havilland, and he really worked through that before the war. The after-war Jim Stewart was nothing like that. He had nothing more to prove as far as, being attractive to ladies.
And of course, this is one of his more famous movies before the war. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which I'm guessing just about everybody has seen. And we could put up quite a few other posters like this. And I only put this one up and cover those first couple of slides to make the point that Jimmy Stewart in 1939, 1940, 41 was already a major Hollywood star and a huge celebrity before the war. Well, I did get another one. Here's the Philadelphia story. The couple of other well-known actors. Yet, with all that celebrity, all that status, what does he do relative to joining the military, Robert?
He got drafted. People mistake the fact that, they think, oh, he enlisted before the war. Well, he was drafted. But the trick there is that he wanted to be drafted. He said it was the only lottery he ever won. He wanted to go in. Mission is, the title Mission is really about his family's mission to serve their country. And so he was eager to get into the service. He had to fight to get into the service because he did not match up on the height and weight ratios. He was deferred at first. He worked his way in, and it started an uphill climb that he had through the war. It was always an uphill climb for him to get into combat.
And he joined as an enlisted man, right?
Yeah, he started out as a private, became a corporal, then he won his wings in January of 42 and was a second lieutenant. Then he trained on twin engine bombers and became a first lieutenant. Then he trained on four engine bombers, B-17s, and became a captain.
And I think this is the cockpit of one of the bombers he flew. Can you tell, is this a 17 or a 24?
Oh, ask an expert. I'm just a writer.
Colin, can you recognize that? Is that
I would say that looks like a 24. I'm looking at the windscreen.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. And I forgot that Jimmy in the war and becomes a B-24 pilot and flies B-24s. And I suspect I included this because it was a B-24.
But he was trained on B-17s and he instructed on B-17s. He trained quite a number of pilots that he would then see over in England.
Was that common for a pilot to be trained on both 17s and 24s?
He was trained on 17s, but when his only chance of getting into the shooting war was with B-24s, with a new bomb group that came online. And so he took a crash course in 24s. Liberators.
Did he ever comment on the 24 versus B-17 sort of controversy, if you will, or discussion?
Nope.
No. Did he ever subsequently fly 17s during the war, his war experience?
Never. Always liberators.
Always Liberators. Interesting. Okay. And so finally, can you retell the story as I recall in the book a little vaguely? He had to really work hard to get a combat assignment because the Air Force just didn't want to risk such a major celebrity name being in combat like this. How did he finally finagle his way into combat?
He had a champion at one of the air bases that saw how much he was suffering. And so he really went to bat for Stuart to get him a combat assignment. And it just so happened that history helped him out because, as you see in Masters of the Air, the first wave was decimated pretty much. And he was part of the second wave, a new bomb group, 445th. Started out at Gowan and then went to Sioux City, and he picked it up at Sioux City and became first he was going to be an operations officer, but he became a squadron commander because, everybody could see what a good flyer he was. He was so much more mature. And that's one of the problems that he faced, is he was so much older than everybody else around him, including the base commander of the 445th at Tibbenham. He was older than the base commander. He was 35, 36 years old when he started flying in combat, and that's really, dicey, I think. And it's one of the reasons that he cracked up after 11 missions. It's just because, he didn't quite have the stamina of a 22-year-old.
Pretty understandable.
Sure.
I mean, today I think of a 34 or 35 year old as pretty young, but when you're 35 and comparing yourself to 21 and 22 year olds, it's a big difference.
Yeah.
What do you think, what drove him to this? What made him desire to be in combat, especially a man who easily, with just a phrase to any senior person in the military, could have avoided combat?
The answer goes back to the Civil War. Both of his grandfathers served in the Union Army. One was a sergeant in the Shenandoah Valley for the Valley Campaign of 1864 into 65, was at battles like New Market and Cedar Creek. And his other grandfather was Samuel Jackson, who was one of the heroes of Gettysburg, made a charge from the base of Little Round Top. There's a monument to him at Gettysburg, became a general. And both of these men left a legacy. In fact, Sergeant J.M. Stuart, who Jim was named after, lived till 1933 and told him all about what real war was like. There was just a family service mission. Jim's father was a captain of ordnance in the Great War. And that was during Jim's formative years, like he's 10 years old and his father's overseas, sending back souvenirs, sending back stories. And this all just became imprinted on him. And in a sense, it was like a crushing burden that he knew he would have to serve. That's why he became a pilot. That's why he bought a Stinson Voyager with his money from Hollywood and flew that and logged his hours because he wanted to be an army flyer. That's all he wanted to be. And that's why he was so happy to leave Hollywood.
Yeah. And he grows up in, the old small town America atmosphere. Indiana's small today. I can't imagine what it was in the 1920s. And that must have played a role in his makeup as well. His father, didn't their family own a hardware store? Do I remember that right?
Oh yeah, a hardware store. His father was very well known in the community. They were very well known in the Presbyterian Church. So yeah, I mean, like he was a small town boy. Of course, he kind of, sort of went Hollywood during the later 1930s, but then he grew tired of Hollywood. He wasn't getting the parts that he wanted to get. He was put into musicals and really sort of bad pictures. And that was another reason he was just happy to get away. Start over, start fresh.
And subsequently, I mean, his persona really comes through as the all American in all his most of his movies, anyway.
Before the war. After the war, he took on much darker roles, which, is reflective of what he had gone through in the war.
This is just a shot of an air base. I don't think it's Tibbenham for sure. I think it might be Thorpe's Albert, Thorpe's Abbotts, because I was pulling some pictures on that for some other reasons. Was it you, Robert, who was telling me how much you admired the sets that the TV series had built portraying these bases?
I love it. I love it. I love seeing the control tower. I love seeing the mess hall. I love seeing, the briefing room. I love seeing the them being debriefed after the missions. I just love all that. It's like mission has come to life.
I've been listening to the podcast. I don't know if any of you have, but there's a podcast that you can access that comes out after the episode comes out. They're interviewing different executives, producers, and producers of the TV series. But Don Miller is always featured as well. But one of the executive producers described their the size of the air base they built to replicate this that you're seeing here, along with the air tower. And I think they built two of them for some reason. And they also built, as you'll see, I think more so in subsequent episodes, a huge POW camp that looks, from the little clips I've seen, the trailers, looks also very real. So, Colin, you have any thoughts? When I look at you, Colin, you always seem to be on the verge of having something to say.
Not really. I mean, you mentioned the POW camps, and as you know, Marilyn Walton and I will be with you later. But her father was in that Stalag Luft 3 where a lot of these guys ended up. That was like the biggest camp for flyers, for American flyers. And I'm looking in great detail because I've walked a lot. I went to a lot of former camps that were, now museums and all over England, the airfields. I did postgraduate school for 4 years in Britain, so I got time off to go check things out. But no, I find the set decorations and the and everything they did was to scale. I found nothing stands out at me as a historian that says, "My God, why did they do this?" So no, I mean I'm very pleased with the detail the attention to detail they had.
Yeah, it's unquestionably like Hanks and Spielberg always do. And of course, $250 million buys you an awful lot.
Well, yeah, the budget started out as 200, 200 plus million, but I think it ended up being closer to 500 with the COVID shutdowns and the insurance payouts.
Oh, what's a couple of bucks between friends?
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
I mean, plus I got my payout of it, so what the hell, you
Yeah. That explains the inflated budget there, Colin.
yeah, that's the overhead right there.
And Robert, you visited Tibbenham. Do I have that pronounced correctly?
Yeah, Tibbenham, yeah. I was there. It's it's very bleak today. The landing strips are all there. There are some Nissen huts left. That shot that you showed of Jim walking in front of barracks. Yeah, that one. That barrack still stands. It's now a chicken coop on in a farm field. But you can still see where the Franklin stove was. You can still get a sense of how damp and cold, because I was there in November, which is when Jim landed. And it really is a very bleak place in the middle of nowhere.
Is the control tower still there at Tibbenham?
No, they pulled down the control tower in 1980s, I believe.
Yeah. I don't know how many there are. I don't think too many control towers left. I know the one at Thorpe's Abbotts is there because it's been turned into a museum for the 100th Bomb Group. And we'll be visiting that one. There probably, I don't know, Colin, are there a couple of others still available, still seeable?
In England, I don't think most of them are now just torn down. They're like, Robert said. I mean, they've converted these things into farmland or other use. Other than the area around Duxford, you don't really have a lot of still standing complete airfields.
Well, I mean, obviously they needed to go back to farming when the war was over. So, Robert, this photo is Jim Stewart there in the middle.
That's Jim, and it's one of the days he's not flying. I assume that there's a mission up, and that's why he's at the tower.
Do we know who the fella who looks pretty much like a civilian
No,
is?
I don't know. I don't know who that is.
I think that photograph is Winston Churchill.
Really? Yeah.
Really?
I think it's Winston Churchill because I knew his daughter-in-law, and I interviewed her, and she said that Winston knew Jim Stewart and Clark Gable both, and that he visited them sometimes. And Jimmy Stewart seconded that, so I'm assuming it's probably him.
I hadn't caught until you said that. I hadn't thought about it. It's certainly his silhouette and maybe his face. Jim was very publicity shy during this time frame, right, Robert?
He was openly hostile to the media because he did not want to be distracted. He had no interest in being fodder for articles or publicity. The only exception to that was when he begrudgingly agreed to star in Winning Your Wings, the short that was used to recruit flyers in the early part of the war. He did one press conference in England, and that was shortly after his arrival. He went to London, did one press conference. That was it. He was happy to be locked down on secure air bases away from the press.
And this is him with one of the crews that he had. Do you recall which plane this was, or at what point in his mission experience?
This is Bill Connolly is standing in the center, one of Jim's pilots. He was about the only pilot who was as tall as Jim. He was 6'3". So that's his crew, and Jim was always flying in the right seat because he was the quarterback, the aerial quarterback on a lot of his missions. Leading his group, leading by the end of the war, he was leading the whole combat wing, in the right seat.
And maybe for our viewers who don't quite understand that remark, and you see it in the TV series as well, and I understand it because I've read enough and read your book and other books, but I don't think a lot of viewers understand what you mean when you say the right seat for Jimmy Stewart or any of the squadron and bomber commanders, what bomber group commanders. What was going on there?
The right seat is the co-pilot seat, because when you're the pilot, you got plenty to do without looking around you and trying to tighten the formation or make slight adjustments here and there. So he was in the co-pilot seat with really the best pilots in the group, and that was Bill Connelly, one of those really, really good flyers. And there were others that he favored, that he wanted to go up with because they were so good.
But what is his responsibility being in the right seat and being the either squadron or group commander on a mission?
Like I say, he's the one that communicates. He's the one that makes decisions. He's the one that keeps the group together. And he really keeps the group calm. And that was one of the great things about Stewart, was that he was a master communicator. He was a Hollywood actor.
Yeah.
He could act his way through a mission. He could convey accurately, succinctly, what they should do in the air. And that's as far as I know. I mean, there are people like Colin, I'm sure, knows more than I do about, like, a group commander in the air, a wing commander, when they're on a mission.
The other part about Jimmy Stewart is, would you say he had a command personality or commanding personality?
He did, and there were a lot of anecdotes that flyers in his group and the other group that he was in, the 453rd, they talked about Gee Whiz Jimmy Stewart, sort of like he was Harvey, from the movie Harvey. But that wasn't wartime Jim at all. That was just, that's what happens over the decades when you start getting these anecdotes. But he was a by-the-book flyer, and he was a by-the-book leader. He was a captain, then he was a major, and he did not suffer fools, and he did not cut slack. He was a tough, tough leader.
Can I
Interesting.
tell you something that Curtis LeMay said about Jimmy Stewart?
Of course.
Sure.
Curtis LeMay told me during my interview with him, he said, have you talked to Jimmy Stewart yet? And I said, no, how do I get to him? Well, I'll do a letter for you. Anyway, so what happened was Jimmy Stewart had a nickname, just like Patton had blood and guts, or he had, and LeMay had iron pants. Jimmy Stewart had Death Stalker because he was known to write men up just to the point of a court martial for any infraction that was considered above and beyond what an officer or an enlisted man should do, except for the beer keg story. He didn't do anything about the beer that was stolen that he caught in the barracks. But what he did do, one of his lieutenants, the bombardier, just happened to drop the Norden bomb sight on the tarmac and broke it, and his career was over. It went all the way to LeMay's desk, then Doolittle, but at that time when he took over as 8th Air Force, are we going to court-martial this guy for destroying a bomb site? And Stewart's letter response back to him, and Stewart told me this. He said, I told that boy to keep his hands on it, but he just didn't listen to me. But he broke a bomb site, and he punished him for it.
Wow. Another shot of Jimmy Stewart with another group of men, I believe. Do you recognize any of these other men around him, Robert?
I think that is Sherrard, another one of his pilots on the right, another one of his favorite pilots.
I think that is Sherrard.
Jimmy Stewart at first is a squadron commander. And then he transitions to be a bomber group commander. How did that happen? How long did it, over what time frame did that happen, Robert?
So when he went to England, he was with the 445th at Tibbenham, and then after about 12 missions, after he had cracked up once and gone flak happy, which they sort of pay lip service to in Masters of the Air episode 4, but they don't really, get at what flak happy means. After he had gone away for a while, he came back to the 445th and he was transferred to the 453rd, where he was on the ground most of the time and in operations because he really had lost his fastball in the air. And he was like instrumental on the ground in the operations leading up to D-Day, which is like my favorite chapter in the book is when they locked down for that and when they were flying those tactical missions over the channel. So it's not that he became a commander in the air so much. This was, the first 12 missions were so tough on him. He only flew 8 more missions over the course of the next year, basically, because he was having more and more trouble with fatigue and really PTSD.
And let's talk a little bit about these flak houses, which is what we believe he was sent to recuperate. I think, do I remember correct? Does anybody comment on this? Do I remember correct in the episode, one of the episodes, they do mention that term, flak house. Am I imagining that? Nope, maybe not. Okay. So what's a flak house, Robert, Colin? Robert?
I'll give that one to Robert.
Well, it's at least one country estate in the northern part of England, which was away from everything, where you could dry out, where you could relax, where you could, play ping pong, you could swim, you could whatever it took for you to decompress. Plus, they were giving sodium annatol to people to get them to relax, get them to, get rid of their pent up hostility, their pent up fears. And you got 10 days of that, maybe you got 7 days, 10 days, and then you were sent back, to the flight line, pick it back up.
Yeah, just so you know, our military was a lot more lenient with the guys who had PTSD than the British were. The British were absolutely ruthless with their people. There was no mercy shown.
We called it combat fatigue, I think, at the time. What did the British call it, Colin?
Lack of moral fiber.
Hard to believe.
I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you a true story. I wrote a book called Night Fighters. That was my master's thesis. Here's the deal. I interviewed a guy. I'm going to try to remember. He had flown maybe 20 something missions as a crewman on a Stirling's Lancasters. Anyway, he had come back on so many sh ships that were just scrapped and guys dead, parts all over the place, and he just melted down. And the guy had a distinguished flying cross. He had every medal except the Victoria Cross. I mean, this guy was decorated. They made him a janitor and put in his file that he was a coward, lack of moral fiber, not to be promoted. Go figure.
Hard to believe the attitude they had. At least ours was a bit more understanding. Well, maybe a lot more understanding. Sean, while it's 8 o'clock, let's pause just for a moment here, Sean. Are there questions in the chat room or questions from the audience in general that anybody would like to pose to Robert Mattson about Jimmy Stewart or anything?
Ira Martin put in, what part of the production or participation in the Glenn Miller story plays into Jimmy Stewart's experience as a pilot? I always felt the casting wasn't random and was connected to Stewart on a deeper level. The ending was a pilot's nightmare.
Yeah, that it's interesting to see Stewart in uniform, the uniform of the 8th Air Force in the Glenn Miller story. And the way it ends is just so creepy and mysterious when he just goes off and he's gone. He's dead. So the wartime overlap really is very interesting. I don't know that he wanted that role for that reason. It was a safe picture for him. He was making some really oddball films at that time. He was taking chances as an actor, but the Glenn Miller story was money in the bank. It was a huge success. So I think that's why he took that on. And he had actually seen Glenn Miller perform at the 445th base at Tibbenham in January or February of 44.
Wow. Other questions?
Anybody'd like to raise or wave their hand? Joe McCarthy in the chat. Did Jimmy participate in enlistment films or war bond tours?
War bond tours, absolutely not. No interest whatsoever. And the only time he participated in an enlistment film was Winning Your Wings when they snuck up on him. Warner Brothers sent a truck up and a crew up to Moffett Field and snuck up on him. And he was actually in the air. He looked down, he saw this truck. Owen Crump, who was the director who made that film, left an oral history and talked extensively about Stewart's, four-letter words when he landed and saw that this thing had come here, and he wasn't aware that he was supposed to participate in this thing. But then when he realized the impact he could have, and it was explained to him, this is exactly what this is about, then he went along with it. And it was an extremely successful training or recruitment tool early in the war.
Kevin in the chat, did Stewart feel guilt for having done recruiting shorts?
No, not at all. I think he when he did that one, that was all that he felt like he was supporting the war effort, really. And that's what turned him around and made him do it. And so I would think no, there would be no guilt there.
Walter, I'll ask you to unmute.
Thank you. Well, Robert, it's good to see you again. And you've made a you've I just want to make an observation. You talked about the immediacy of Masters of the Air, and I was suddenly reminded of something that Bert Stiles said early in his narrative as a co-pilot of B-17 in the 91st group. And it's simply this: a good part of the time here, there was no past and certainly no future. There was only the now of any oxygen mask, and the now of Berlin or Kiel from 30,000 feet. That now is just as mixed up as the past, and sometimes just as beautiful.
Wow, pretty powerful.
Hey, Glenn.
Yes, sir.
My book, Above the Reich, I want to read what Jimmy Doolittle told me about Stewart, just a couple of paragraphs, just for the mood.
Could you paraphrase him for us, or?
Yeah, basically, he just said that Jimmy Stewart had, been flying his missions. He called him a warrior. He couldn't believe how humble he was, being a big movie star, wealthy, famous. He was willing to give it all up. Same with Clark Gable. And then he said, but he could see it now, either Stewart or Gable getting shot down and captured or killed, and the newspapers back home having Doolittle kills movie stars on the front page. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
I could. If I were in his shoes, I'd be worried about it too, because he may never been able to go home had that happened.
But Hermann Goering was a big fan of Jimmy Stewart's movies. Hermann Goering put a bounty on Stewart of 100,000 Reichsmarks. And Adolf Hitler, not to be outdone, put a bounty on Clark Gable because Eva Braun's favorite film was Gone with the Wind. True story.
Is how. Were there any known attempts by the Germans to target Jimmy Stewart on his air raids to gain public victory over a Hollywood star?
Not that I'm aware of, Colin.
No, they didn't know. They knew the unit he was in, but when a raid was started, the Germans never knew which bomber groups or wings were involved. They had no idea until they shot down a bomber and they interrogated a crew. They could find out from the aircraft information which unit it was. The Germans had the Abwehr had great intel. But yeah, I mean, like I said, Goering placed a bounty on Stewart. Hitler placed a bounty on Gable. Whichever German fighter pilot shot him down was going to be a rich man. And luckily, nobody collected on the money. But no, they had the Germans didn't go up looking for Stewart or Gable. They worried about trying to survive themselves.
One more from Vince. Did Stewart ever mention how his war experience affected his performance as an actor after the war? Good question.
Well, if we could hold off answering that for two or three more slides, Robert gets into that quite deeply. And we'll answer that question in about 5 or 10 minutes. Is that okay?
Perfect.
Okay, let me go back to sharing this the screen here. There's just a few more slides, but we get into exactly that point here in a minute. So Bomber group commander, and he wins. I imagine this is the Distinguished Air Medal.
That's the DFC. That's DFC? The first one he won.
Distinguished Flying Cross. Okay. And I think I just have some shots of you know, the incredible, disastrous wreckage and combat. I mean, you can't, these photos I think are pretty poignant, but they don't touch what the actual miniseries does because they make it look like you were there. One more shot of Jimmy Stewart. You can see just how darn tall he is. Or was. What is he, six? Was he 6'4"?
He was 6'3 and a half.
Three and a half. Looked taller because of his build, I think. You know, he like an NBA basketball player of the day. Which, do we, at this point, he's in front of this plane called the Mail Call. Is he a bomber group commander at this point, Robert? Do you know?
No, he's still the squadron commander at the 445th at this point.
Becomes bomber group commander. He's bomber group commander, I think you said earlier, during the build up to D-Day and the subsequent to that.
He was actually the 453rd's operations officer at that time. Not a bomb group commander. No, I don't. He never achieved that because of just the circumstances of his missions, but he did lead missions, you know, at the group level and at the wing level, ultimately.
Okay. And you said he had two visits to the Flak House. He has a subsequent problem as well, Robert? When did that occur?
Yeah, the first one is pretty easy to figure out, but the second one, which I learned about from one of his co-pilots, that one is shrouded in mystery, exactly when that happened.
Yeah. And certainly not something anybody wants to put out there and advertise. I mean, Don Miller, in his book and in the podcast I've listened to him, talks about how the bomber group commanders would try to obfuscate, try to hide, try to minimize the number of men who were suffering from combat fatigue because they were under pressure to put planes in the air with crews. And, you know, whatever, I think Don Miller thinks that 2,000 men were reported with from the 8th Air Force were reported with combat fatigue. But he thinks the number was 5, 6, 7 times more than that in reality. Just not reported.
Not to get off on a tangent, but suicide was also a problem, like a big problem.
That's
it. They kept it very quiet.
Do we know the numbers there?
I don't, but I was looking at documentation from the 445th where you know there are veiled references to suicides.
Ah, no, that's something I'm not familiar with. No.
That's because they kept it so quiet.
And this is the photo. I'm not sure what this squiggly line, if you guys are seeing that, where that came from. I just find this remarkable photo. And I've been doing some lectures on the air war over Europe at local libraries and historical societies, and I include this. Tell us about this, Robert. It comes from your book.
Yeah, so on the left is Jim in January 1942, boyish Jim Stewart, full head of hair. Just had won his wings, Second Lieutenant Stewart. So that's January 42. And the photo on the right is June 1944. So 2.5 years later, after 12 missions and one trip to the Flak House, that's Jim. Just looking like his own father, practically. You know, that's the emotional toll that that command took on him and that the missions took on him, because he was such a perfectionist. And when he lost one of his flyers or one of his planes, he took it very personally. It was something he did wrong. Yeah. He had to write those letters home And he took it all so personally.
In your book, you describe that part so well, Robert, and it really makes you understand the burden of command, the burden of having to make the decisions, who was going up and in what part of the formation, and the feeling of responsibility when somebody didn't come back. And Jim felt it.
Especially when you're a perfectionist, and he was a perfectionist.
Trying to perfect something that could not be perfected. That's the fundamental issue there, right? I mean, even
I if I could interject, I asked General Stewart during my interview with him, his assistant Sharon Margolis is very, very cordial in setting this up. I asked him, I said, "What about the war was the hardest part for you? Everybody has their story." He said, "Writing the letters."
And this is just illustrative of one man. I mean, thousands of men, would have this same story. So now let's, unless there's a question from the audience, let's talk about a little bit about answering the question of what happens to Jimmy Stewart after the war.
There is one question after that.
Okay, so I have to credit Walt Powell because Walt's here tonight. I see him right there. When I had the manuscript before it was final, I sent it out for peer review, and he was one of the reviewers, and he hammered me. I mean, he was merciless with me. I will never forget the conversation. His wife heard it. She was shocked, where he just pilloried me for not really understanding what it was like for these guys coming home. He referred me to the book, Soldier from the War Returning, and it really opened my eyes. And then I talked to Jim's daughter about what her father was like, after the war, and I'm talking like she wasn't born till 1949, so she remembers him from the 1950s, 1960s, where he would sit in his study by himself and stare. Jim's wife talked about nightmares, fits of temper, like crazy fits of temper. That's the Jim that came home from the war. And did he ever talk about how he channeled his wartime experiences into his films? No, but esoterically, he would say that, your life affects your work. You use your life experiences in your work. That's as close as he would come to saying anything about the war in the context of his career.
And you referred to somebody, Walt Powell.
Yes, Walter Powell, he's right there.
Hello, Walter Powell. And Walter was your editor for the book?
Not my editor, but he was a peer reviewer. I sent him the manuscript, and he gave his comments because he's quite an authority on the Eighth Air Force, and I counted on him to correct any mistakes I was making.
Walter, could we recognize you and ask you to make some comments about Jimmy Stewart and Robert Mattson, for that matter? We'll roast Robert. How's that?
Well, I'm delighted. Just briefly, it's a pleasure to see Robert again. We go back a few years, even before World War II, not literally, but figuratively. There were so many dimensions of this story as Robert was unfolding them. And one of the things that struck me, and Robert, you should comment on this, that powerful scene in the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, vis-a-vis Stewart's post-war trauma. Did you want to just remind the audience about that, the scene in the film, the first one he filmed, if I recall correctly?
Yeah, so he comes back from the war and he can't get any parts because he looks like his own father. I mean, he's not a leading man anymore in his own eyes. And the picture that he's offered is It's a Wonderful Life, which is not what he wanted to make because it's about, a man thinking about suicide and an angel, and it's just goofy in his mind. But he does it. And there are several scenes where you can clearly see a man just back from the war. That is one of them. When he's sitting in Martini's bar and he's praying and he's crying, and they did that as a static shot. Capra said, okay, cut. He had poured his heart and soul into that scene. And Capra said, okay, let's do it again. We're going to do a slow push in. And Stewart said, I can't, you know, that's all I had in me is that one. That's one example of wartime Jim come home. And another one is when he's in his living room and he breaks his living room apart. You know, he's got this model and he destroys the model and he's throwing things and his children are crying and his wife is terrified. And I mean, like, you could see a man on the edge. I just think it's so remarkable that that film captured in, and there was another scene where he runs into the foreground of the camera, like it's an extreme close-up, and his eyes are wild. I mean, this is not a Jim Stewart anybody had seen before the war.
I have to give a shout-out to a Gettysburg Breakfast Club, since that's the appropriate title of this group, called the Gettysburg Flyboys. Now, though it continues today, it had no longer, sadly, is any more World War II 8th Air Force or Air Force veterans, but that group was founded back in the 90s by a gentleman named Clem Leone of the 445th Group at Tibbenham. And having been with those men who were, of course, a generation older than I was, but who took me in as one of them and opened up in a way that I never imagined they would. When Robert and I first connected on the project that Robert was working on, I was immensely grateful to these men who had shared so many stories. And one was Clem. As those of you who've read Robert's book know, Clem features in the book, and Clem had a good bit to offer of his own extraordinary experiences. And I think someone in the chat room noted that the anniversary big week, of course, is coming up very shortly. Clem was shot down on the 22nd of February, 1944, during big week, and was one of only five men in his crew that survived. He was lucky. It's a long story, and Robert tells it very well in his book on Stewart. So that's another thing about the narrative that Robert crafts that I didn't visualize, but which came across so well, which was contrasting two men from two different backgrounds. One, Italian kid from Baltimore who was eager to get in despite his mother, who, has an only son and desperately doesn't want him to join. And then this man from Indiana, PA, who does what we know so much about. And both have extraordinary experiences, obviously one a lot better known than the other. But Robert made Clem was already pretty well known in the greater Gettysburg area, but Robert made him even a bigger celebrity in the greater Gettysburg area for a man who deserved the attention that he got. And he was always willing to talk about it. It was his way, I think, of coping with it.
We back a couple of years ago, when we first had Robert on, we had that included in our story from his book, and it is very powerful.
When I was,
are you an author, Walter, as well?
Well, I am. Yes, though not specifically on World War II. Although, like many of you in this audience, I've lectured widely on the subject and traveled to many of the bases in the UK and elsewhere, and spent a lot of time with the men of the greatest generation, including my father, my grandfather, two of my great uncles, two of whom did indeed suffer from PTSD in the same way that Stewart did.
Well, thank you for being on tonight, Walter. We appreciate that. Hopefully you can join us more in the future.
Walter mentioned the big week. The question about that was, can you briefly talk about how important that was in the bombing campaign?
Robert or Walter or Colin, would you like to volunteer any comments on the big week?
Well, I can tell you what the Germans thought about it.
I imagine they had a very interesting view of it. So
yeah, well, Adolf Galland, General of the Fighters, who was a friend of mine for many years, he said that, and he and Doolittle became friends after the war. But he said when Jimmy Doolittle launched Big Week, he said that destroyed the Luftwaffe. There was no recovery after that. There was nothing they could do. They could replace the aircraft, but there was no way in happy hell they could replace the pilots who were lost. And the vast majority of the pilots lost on the Western Front were lost in February 44, as opposed to the previous 2 years and the year after the war.
Interesting.
Yeah, and Big Week is what broke Jim. He was, so Clem got shot down on the first mission to Gotha on February 22nd, Jim flew the second mission to Gotha on the 24th, and that was the mission when a flak shell came up through the flight deck between Jim's feet, and he had to fly back, and they lost an engine, and he made it back to Tibbenham, and when the plane landed, it cracked at the flight deck from that shell burst, and that was it for Jim. That was just too much.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay. It we're getting towards our stop time, which we like to respect. Well, that being said, I want to thank Robert a second time for his second interview with the Veterans Breakfast Club. And he's been on a couple of these shows on Thursday nights when he can make them and contributing. Robert, thank you again.
Thank you, Glenn. Thank you, everyone. Really appreciate it.
Got any new books coming out soon, Robert, you'd like to mention?
Well, as a matter of fact, my latest is called Season of the Gods, which is about the making of Casablanca and the backstory of that. And it's been optioned to Hollywood. So we'll see.
Season of the Gods, Casablanca, the movie.
That's correct.
You just sold a copy. I'm going to run out.
Excellent. That's one fun.
Got to be one of my favorite all-time movies. I've got it memorized, you know.
yeah, make that two copies.
Excellent. Thank you, Colin.
Colin, as always, thank you for your contribution. Your knowledge is incredible. And in 2 weeks' time, we are going to have Colin on as a featured guest with Marilyn Walton. Do I have that name right?
Yeah. Marilyn worked on Masters of the Air as well. She was the POW expert.
Yeah, and I picked up her name, and several of our, including Colin, knew her, and she is known as sort of the foremost expert on the American POW experience during World War II in Germany.
Yeah, she's president of the POW Association.
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to that. Next week, we have Steve Snyder on, who's the author of Shot Down, the story of his own father who was shot down. And it's going to kind of parallel the last episode of Master of the Air in this coming episodes, because his father was shot down and was not captured. I believe three or four of the crew members were killed outright. Two or three were captured. Two or three were not captured and entered into the resistance with resistance in trying to escape, and finally did escape. His father actually fought with the resistance for quite a while, with the French and Belgium resistance. So it's an incredible story. And so he'll be our guest next week. Okay. Well, listen, again, we are planning our trip in September of this year to England, September 11th to 18th, to visit the bomber bases, Bletchley Park, the Battle of Duxford, the Battle of Britain air show, first time it'll be on. Put on since before COVID. We already have a few people registered. And if you're interested, please just go to our website. And thank you all for tonight. Very, very much. Really appreciate it. Robert, as always, it's a fun show. Walter, was nice to meet you. Colin. And let me recognize our two World War II veterans that I know are on, Joe Peter Burrs and Ed Cottrell. Thank you very much for joining us. And in another 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to be featuring those two gentlemen and their experiences in the war, which came near the latter part of the war. Thank you all.
Thank you, everyone.
Great show.
We'll see you all Monday night.
Okay. Take care, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you for watching this episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco Free Adagio Health. Tobacco Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org Or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured tobacco-free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was two wonderful conversations, so I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, tobacco-free Adagio Health, for your support. We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt.